Stevens, reel 2.
Bruce, as I mentioned before, my mother took over the catering side of the riding school, and my father at that time received his pension and had helped her, actually. And what seemed to be a fair and pleasant club at the time developed quite a bit, and in years after the war they moved it to larger premises. And so actually it was on my mother's very first experience the whole family relied on, really. As far as I'm concerned, I would have loved to go into journalism, but having had this terrible experience of moving from Austria into Germany, and in 1946 and 47, of course, schools were hardly working, some evening classes. Everything was down in Germany because the black market set in, and for any money one earned, one could probably just trade in a pair of stockings. It was the time where you exchanged goods. Now, I started my first job, actually. I had gone to evening classes. I had matriculated in Austria, what they called Notabitur, about, I should say, 9 months or a year earlier than we should have done. They raced us through the examinations. And I joined, English fascinated me, languages I liked, geography I liked. And Lübeck's Donia works, which were the aeroplane works, the Donia Werke, were taken over by a British company. It was called Number 2 Medium Workshop for their spare parts. And they seemed to be the only, I should say, it's the only complex that was working at the time, because everything was down apart from the normal shops. And I applied for a job as an interpreter and typist at the time, which I felt I could at least use my English, which was very interesting. And here I met, of course, various kinds of Germans who worked there because they were either from Upper Silesia, from the eastern parts of Germany, and also were refugees. And I particularly have still a very good friend who was once a headmaster of a grammar school, and he was telling me terrible tales how the family got back through wars and fronts of wars, and how they fought back and lost everything. And anyway, the family landed in Lübeck, three daughters, and at that time money didn't mean anything. I remember I earned about, I think, 120 marks a month, and then 160 marks, and I could just about exchange my 120 marks for two pairs of stockings. And everybody talked in cigarettes. I mean, for instance, cigarettes were worth so much that you immediately tried and exchanged your money into cigarettes. And with these cigarettes, you could exchange, say, underwear, stockings, shoes, because so much had been destroyed in Germany, and it wasn't worth exchanging your money for anything else, because you couldn't buy anything. That everybody just exchanging. And this friend of ours told me that his wife managed to bring back a pair of earrings, valuable earrings, from an aunt used to have these in Silesia. And he said, well, we must have potatoes, and we must have a sewing machine, because the children have to wear something. We have to make out of some material we've got some clothing. And one day he came into the office and said, I managed it. So many sacks of potatoes for one earring, and the other one I exchanged for a sewing machine, an old sewing machine somebody had and his wife managed to get, and so we can make some clothes. And these were people whose family had been very well off in Eastern Germany. And we are still in contact today with them. And the daughter, that used to be tiny, appeared, in fact, about a year ago outside my house here. And she said, do remember me, I'm so-and-so. We're just traveling to England. She had her two children with her, and it was rather interesting. And she said, you know, she said, you gave me the first orange I ever had. And I said, I'm amazed. She said, yes, you came to our house once. She said, would you like an orange? And she said, the first orange I ever had and remembered in my life. Yes, because you couldn't get any fruit. It was very difficult. And I think my mother must have had connections and we had some fruit at home. And that was that. And in number two medium workshop, well, they were repairing trucks for the British Army, and we had a big spare part sort of department. And there, of course, for me, it meant doing a lot of bookkeeping and reordering spare parts and so on. And this is the first time I realized I also had a friend there who had come from Eastern Pomerania, whose son was born on the journey in the most primitive circumstances, and her husband, who was a teacher at the time, they were hardly married a few months, and he was killed actually on the East Front. She never saw him again, nor did the son ever see the father. And she came with her parents from Eastern Germany, and she stayed for years in a camp because her father couldn't work very well. He was quite old and ill, and she was the only one who earned money really for the family. And she had some terrible tales to tell, how they sort of came from the east via northern Germany and settled in Lübeck.
Did you find that you only mixed with refugees because of shared experiences?
Well, to a certain extent in this particular job, there were quite a number, because the old Lübeck people, they were either shopkeepers or kept their property, or after all, if they were civil servants, they still stayed there. And these people who hadn't lost anything later on in time were made to pay a certain amount of money towards the upkeep of refugees in the country. Now, Germany became not one Western Germany, but every province a different state with a different administration. And they released laws as they thought it was fit in this particular region. And I remember they had to pay a certain amount. They were told to pay a certain sum of their income towards the upkeep, which of course did not help sort of relations between refugees and the actual people who stayed there. And I think that's led to a lot of friction at the time. But
did the refugees stay in Lübeck and make a home there?
I think many stayed and many drifted towards the west, because I think as the industries in the Ruhr in Western Germany, coal and so on, were built up again, people sort of tended to go there, especially the younger people, because they could earn more money. But before they could earn more money, up to 1948 summer, it must have been July, I believe, of course we still had this bartering money, because it wasn't worth anything. You couldn't go to a jeweler and buy anything unless you brought some silver. And I remember having as a present some cufflinks made, because they weren't there. The person said, well, I make some for you. And I had to take some old rings along in exchange. And you see, because there was no precious metal or anything there, because if it was there, it was hidden under the counter and went for a lot of money to people who could afford to pay in goods, really. But I was on the island of Sylt on a holiday in July 40. Eight, it must have been, and suddenly an announcement was made: everybody in Germany, wherever they are, had their money blocked and had to exchange their present money for the new mark. And at that time, I remember, I believe we only got 60 marks per person, even. That was all, wherever you are. I remember reporting to the local administration, sort of town hall, and I was given this money. It could have been 30 marks, I'm not sure now. And it was just about enough to get one home quickly. Or people had to hitchhike if they were far away or things like that, because all money was blocked again. And from that moment onwards, people had to earn money to pay for their food, for their clothes, for their keep. And everything, it was amazing, was suddenly there, things you couldn't get. Now, for instance, I had a colleague and a good friend in the office who was expecting a baby. And she said, well, we can't get any cotton wool or anything at all, baby food or anything. So they sort of kept her mother-in-law was an old Lübecker and had various sort of household things still intact, and she kept exchanging things, a spoon here or a knife there, or that might have been made of silver, or any crystal vases and so on, and for odd things. But the moment actually the German mark came into being, people had to earn money. So for your first month's salary, you could probably just get by. And slowly, the state sort of made money available of the savings one had, if one had savings at that time, and one could sort of draw on them, let's say 10% of whatever was in the post office at a certain time. And this is how the German economy really started up again. And from then onwards, you could see people were working. It was worth their while. They could buy goods. And this terrible exchange of cigarettes and against goods sort of disappeared. And I think this idea, really, the cigarette idea, came because there were so many occupation troops. There were the Americans, the British, the French, who had sort of goods available, food especially. And I remember this was the time of the American care parcels coming into Western Germany. And well, I believe the care organization sent big parcels of clothing from America, which it collected, or even ex-army clothing, which then went on sale and people could buy it, or it was distributed in refugee camps, you see. So it was quite a terrible time, really.
What was the morale like? Because you said you had no desire, no sort of recompense to work if it was just on a bartering basis.
Yes, but once, this is quite true, when still went to work, but you see, we still had ration cards even after the war. So one's essentials, although I believe England had ration cards for much longer than we did in Germany afterward, let's say the essentials like flour, butter and bread and meat, one could still get as per the ration card, and for which you just paid your normal price. But anything like shoes, clothing, well, couldn't talk of luxuries at all, just had to be earned before you could sort of get it. And at the time, of course, the black market time, I believe, was terrible, because you saw on sort of street corners people just exchanging things, saying, can you let me have so-and-so? I give you so-and-so in exchange. I mean, I wasn't so much affected of it, because being living in a family as a daughter, but I believe many older people, many people out of work did this. But my parents maintained they were going to work. Yeah. And this was probably a good thing. If you had a lot of time on your hands, and as many refugees did, I believe the camps were terrible, inasmuch as people always talked about the old times and when we get back. The idea of getting back in a year, 2, 5 years or 10 years, even now people talk about in Germany, one day we might get back. But although they've given up hope now, and of course the German economy is so good, they're much better off in Western Germany. But my uncle, whom I met again last Christmas, has been back to Stettin for 2 years running, because the authorities, the Polish authorities and the Western German state, have negotiated agreements by which buses, providing they are run under certain travel arrangements, can go into Pomerania. And he was very keen, as he had spent most of his life before he was listed into the army in 1939 in Stettin, to go back. And he did tell me all about it at Christmas, because he said they went back to the house my parents used to live in, which wasn't there anymore, which is completely gone. So had we stayed there, we probably would have perished. He went back to his second wife's house, who by mere chance only lived about 10 kilometers, we didn't know it at the time, from where we used to live. And she told me that their house still stands. Her father was a school teacher in a village. And Poles had taken this over, whom they didn't know. They just arrived and said, look, we used to live here and this belonged to us. And they were terribly nice. They absolutely, everybody sort of went over to the east thinking, oh, well, who is living in there now? Who grabbed this? But these Poles were nice, decent, normal people who had also been told, well, you have to settle in this German region. So consequently, like sort of we were told to live in Austria, they were told to live in Pomerania. The same happened again. And they couldn't have been nicer. My aunt said they made them welcome. I think they gave them coffee, if there was coffee, I'm not sure. And they tried to make a home. She said the house was in an appalling state because nothing had been done to it. Everything is sort of state-owned, and that's it, really. You have no private property. And they were friendly, and they said, if you come back another year, we've been here a very short time, we're going to decorate, we make it look nicer. And they did go back. My aunt and uncle went back, I believe, last summer again. And she went back to the house. They were almost friends now, and listening to the stories they had to tell, how they got through the war, or the parents of these young people who lived there now managed, and how they settled. And they said they're very nice people, and they have decorated, and it looks much more friendly, and they're trying to lead a happy life. But it's very awkward when you sort of think you go back to what used to be your home, you see. And my uncle was especially thrilled because the second time they were in a hotel in Stettin, and they were allowed to sort of travel around during the day. And he said, I had one aim, to use the tram wherever I could and look up all the old places I knew. And he was telling us, to me, we didn't live all that long in Stettin because we lived outside. But my mother was very interested because my mother is 13 years older than my uncle, and therefore she remembered it vividly. And they were talking about places that are still there, that haven't been quite destroyed, but other places that don't exist anymore. And there was quite a sort of hectic conversation at Christmas about all this. And that was quite interesting.
Did you feel bitter at all, the fact that you'd lost your homes?
I think my parents felt very bitter. Now, for instance, I remember towards the end in 1946. Now, I must tell you, the house we lived in was partly taken over by the Royal Air Force for their officers' families, to be confiscated for families that joined the officers after the war. I remember talking to two captains at the time, and they were supposed to bring in their own property, which I believe the army sort of rents out to them. And various things had disappeared from our home, such as carpets and so on, we never saw again. But when my mother heard this was going to happen, we moved downstairs to our friend owned this house, an old countess actually, and she said, there's plenty of room down here, you come down till you have to leave for Germany. And so we did, and actually I never saw the families. They must have come after we left, but I remember them measuring the size of the room by walking, putting one foot in front of the other, saying 2 feet, 3, 4, measuring this room. And I was a sort of interpreter for them there on the spot. And he said he could now tell his wife which carpets to bring and so on in size. And when my mother had to leave, she, of course, had to leave all her furniture, everything. See, all we could take is hand luggage. And in order to exist from 45 summer to 46, that we had to leave in Austria, she sort of sold bits of furniture, because after all, as I said, all our money was blocked, and I think the post office account, thank God there was some money in there, was getting rather low. And I remember she sold the sewing machine to one friend and who wanted it, and a whole dining room suite she stored with somebody, subject to them wanting to buy it and her not being able to get it back to Germany. All this sort of was discussed. Bit by bit, she had to let go what she brought into Austria, you see, from Germany. And I think it must have been dreadful, really, because this must have helped her to exist and buy the food we needed. And to let it go like that. And there, I think, she learned who her friends were at the time. Because many people said, oh, look, we've got a spare room, leave it here, and if you want to get it back, you know, get it back later on. And many people just were very, very nasty. And my mother didn't go back. She couldn't face up to it till very, very late, at about, I should say, 6 or 7 years ago, she went back for the first time. And we had still boxes stored with friends, and this is how upstairs on the roof I found my diary, you see. This is the time, the friends in the house said, you know, there are still things upstairs, somewhere, just little kitchen ornaments or whatever. And we said, well, why on earth didn't you throw it away? Oh, she said, I didn't want to. I thought one day you might come back, you see. She was very decent as yours, all they were was pennies nowadays, you know. But she did say, oh, to my mother, do you remember, I still have a wardrobe of your husband. And because my father always had his own wardrobe with uniforms and boots and whatever. And she said, I owe you money. And my mother said, for God's sake, she said, it's years ago, I think it's 46, you don't owe me a penny, it's yours, of course. Well, those were the decent people, you see. And
your father, was he pensioned? He retired when he was 40.
Oh, no, he retired when he was, let me just think back now, I mean, 45, 46, 47. He must have retired 48, 49 or so. You see?
Was that normal, or was it the result of his...
Oh, no, this is 1948, 49. Yeah. No, you can retire 20 or 25 or 30 years when you've been in the police force. And I think the idea after the war was that let the younger people come in and let the older ones, as refugees, also take their pension. Mm. And I don't think he would have been able to fit in anymore after all the experience. After all, he was in his... I was born in 1896, so that's 4 years to go to 1900. So he must have been 50, 51. And his first war years counted double. See, the First World War years counted as double service. He went straight into the police force after the First World War. And so I think he had accumulated so and so many years by which he could retire. And after all, he had to start a new life. And his idea was to help my mother. He was ill at the time. In fact, only a few years later, he died of cancer. And so my mother was left again to look after us and start... carry on. Well, I don't know. Is there anything else I can tell you?
To go down and make good all defects. And so, Watergate's Mountain had to be renewed, so I had to go down. And I reckon I spent about 4 hours or more sitting in front of that boiler, putting in Watergate's glasses, none of which would hold, until eventually, in desperation, I went up to the mess to pour out my troubles and trials, and the chap said to me, well, you know what's wrong, don't you? You're only putting in one hexagon. You put in 1.5, that'll do the trick, and sure enough it did. That's a trick I've never forgotten.
What about your work in port? What was your work? What responsibilities did the junior ERA and the stock hold have? And the ship was alongside or at anchor when you were doing maintenance work.